an afternoon with Paul Laffoley, with commentary by I. Kapur and Freeman.
I'm going down to the river. There's a man I want to see. Yeah, he's a ferryman. He'll recognize me. I'm going down now to the riverside. There's a place I wanna be. Gonna talk to the ferryman. He'll be expecting me. I'm crossing over now to the other side. The grass is greener there on the other side, and I get even there on the other side. And
because there are different colors that are involved in that, in different positions, so that it has a sense of being what we would call scientific at the same time. So that, the things that you draw, as I said, becomes psychotronic. Yeah. Which of course, is like the whole field of psychotronics is simply magic brought back under the guise of science. Right.
So, would you say that some of your paintings are meant to be like screening tools then? Like someone could screen your Kabbalah if they wanted?
Yeah.
Okay, I have another question for you then about screening. Is your painting of the Lalo
Isn't
giant...
scrying?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay, right. Yeah. Flying and scrying.
We'll go with scrying.
Screening and screaming.
Okay. is the Lalo gyre able to be scryed, or does it need to be a mechanical device?
Okay. It's a structured singularity. So it is actually a device. And it's like analyzing what a photon does. Because a photon, maintaining a constant velocity means that as a packet, it's able to hit any other particle with enough energy so that it doesn't get pushed out of the way. So it keeps on going. It's the big dog in town. You know? Even though it's claimed to have no mass, which I find rather an amusing thought, of this thing that can mess around with everything. It's like a bouncer in a barroom that doesn't weigh anything. That's not possible. Okay, the what it is, it's recognizing that the gyroscope is the first step away from mechanism to consciousness. And that's like one of the remnants of the original gyroscope. So like in your ears, you have liquid in them, and it keeps you on track, so you're balanced. And all the rockets have gyroscopes all over the place. I mean, you can put gyroscopes on rings, and hold your hands up. When I got this idea, like sometime in October of 1975, that's when I did it. And it came to me complete, or as complete as I thought at the time. And it was not a regular gyroscope that has one single perceptional axis and then one torque axis, which is like a thick wheel, a massive wheel. And it's a series of nested spheres, so it has gimbals. Only the gimbals are the result of fragmenting the precessional axis. What I mean by that is that a precessional axis tracks two masses, like near the Earth, and then whatever goes up, it hits a star, you know, in terms of that. You turn it and then there's another star, or if you have it, you know, the space is doing two stars or something like that. Okay, but when you fragment that and then redistribute it in space in the form of two interlocking three-dimensional equiangular spirals, you're starting to get the effect of this thing as trying to occupy all the radii in a sphere. Okay, so in terms of a geometric form, a sphere is supposed to be defined as having an infinite number of radii in every single direction that there is. Okay, well, I said that's obviously an unlimited concept, and every machine that I know about has limitations, or else it won't work, because you can't fit it into other contexts. Because if something's unlimited, it's going to occupy everything, you won't even know it's there. You know, just like God. You know? So this has to have part of the limitations of depth. So it has to use the logarithmic or the equiangular spiral, and which is the condition of depth, because the other one, the Archimedes spiral, starts at the source of everything and arithmetically increases until it reaches the cosmic periphery, and it's now a perfect circle. Now, there's no other way to go but down.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, okay. So, but then you start to have to go back, and you make one motion. You just make one angle. And then the next time you do it to the next radii, you're doing the same thing. So that's why it's called an equiangular spiral. And if done correctly, it will make an infinite number of revolutions around the focus, but never arrive. So, but what it's doing, the energy is dying. So that, but it's also recognizing the source with a greater and greater degree of authenticity. Should I be looking correctly on the camera?
Oh, no, I didn't mean
to.
Okay,
none of this
matters.
This is all insanely informal false.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Whatever you want.
Yeah,
okay.
No, we're just...
Yeah, okay. So then, as this comes around, I decided that it can't be, it can't have shells uniformly distributed over a place that's from the centroid to the assumed periphery of how you're going to build the thing. In other words, it has to be done in the Fibonacci series. So it's logarithmic. So you have one here, and then the logarithmically it gets smaller and goes down. And these would be built from fiberglass, stronger than steel. Okay, and then each one has, and then for brakes on it, you have to have a packet of three shells. In other words, two on the outside and one on the inside that would spin in the opposite direction. So that, because if you have no brakes, you have no machine, you know, because every single machine has got to have some way to start, because it's eventually going to screw the world up if the thing keeps working.
Right.
So you got that one going. Then at the torque axis of each of these spheres, I said, let's put a laser beam in a fiber optic bed. Okay, and then you have it going in a perfect circle. In other words, you shoot it in like a slight angle, you know, and then it starts to track like going on a cyclotron. And now you have parts of the thing going at the speed of light when you turn it on. And in each one of those radii that's separated, like you have radio frequency generators that turn on through the use of solenoids, you turn on electric motors that are inside that little part of the fragmented processional axis. And so you have to make this thing big enough so that you can fit components in there and have it work. Now, the place that you have tremendous stresses is where this connects to that outer surface of the sphere, and the next one the same way. So this is an incredible stress factor. So these are areas where the next line of engineering attack to this thing has to go, is that how to resist enormous shear stress that is basically rotating. So it's doing it not like a shell does. You know, you've seen fish shells and stuff like that. It comes up in a spiral. But this, because the spirals are already taken care of in the structure of it, what I want to do is figure out, probably, you know, from the center, you could have stress factors that are going like that. So it looks like when you're looking down on a daisy, you see those lines of force. So that those have to spread out to a certain distance. So this automatically is making the scale of this thing pretty large, you know, to do it. So that's why I wanted to operate in a geostationary orbit where you have zero gravity, so that you can do that. So in other words, so that the resistance to stress factors takes place simply for the material and not additional weight of gravity in the situation. And then, okay, then in between the shells, you have a substance called ferrofluidics. Now, this is like like iron ground finer than pumice in a highly viscous oil. So you can transmit electricity through it like it was copper wire, but it's not.
That'd be a form of nanotech.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and so that it's a crude tech. That's what I'm saying. That probably now an engineer would refine it with just what you're talking about. In other words, with nanobots in there. Okay. But at the time that I did it, I didn't know about nanotechnology.
It's pretty cutting edge.
Right. Yeah.
This thing came to me as a thing that's made of spheres, nested spheres. And the single precessional axis from the north to the south is fragmented and then redistributed in space in the form of two three-dimensional equiangular spirals. So that you have the same thing that you'd have in a regular gyroscope, which is now exaggerated. And at the torque axis in there, you have laser beams in a fiber optic bed. You have some weights to give you the sense of what the torque axis should weigh, but and it's also always in the Fibonacci series. The Fibonacci series is the same thing as the divine proportion, the equiangular spiral, all the mathematics of death. You know, people, like a lot of architects, stick a nautilus shell on the side of a building, they're done, showing they're being organic. Well, actually, they're showing something that's going towards being inorganic. Like when we reach maturity, with all the 0.382 and 0.618 of unity, we're starting to die. Because like a baby has a large head, so it isn't controlled by anything, or like the ginkgo biloba. Does not...
All right.
Can I ask you something about the chakra devices in your time machine? I understand the role that they're playing in kind of like recording the information or oscillating it back.
Well, no. I've also got things like coming in the top of this. I have artificial chakras lined up.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what material would you suggest in these?
Cholesterol.
Okay, you'll have to go into a little more detail.
All right, now see, this is where some of it has to be alive. Okay, but now, I mean, everybody hates cholesterol. I think it's what we're made out of. And the thing is that it's probably true that that the more refined parts of our existence, like chakras, are using refined cholesterol, stuff that is not being affected by our metabolism at all. In other words, so that it stays kind of stable in the situation. And so that the only way you can modulate it is through geometry, you know, like the shapes that you lay it out in, you know, like soap bubbles, so that it stays in them.
Argon has the similar principle of making a geometric matrix.
Right. Yeah. And but the thing is that you it's like you have to put you have to get each one of those seven chakras connected to a shape. Now here's another area of experimentation. I just made up a list of typical forms, two-dimensional forms, and I suspect, you know, that when you use this one, you're down on the first one, you know, because it's like fire. You know, go into traditional associations.
So you're saying this would be a root chakra?
Yeah, right, like that kind of stuff. And, you know, when you're up in the crown chakra, you know, you've got a lot of facets around the thing, you're practically a circle. So that you can begin with traditional definitions of what these are, and you got them up there, and then all the wires and the stuff come down, and the wires come down to the earth, and these are made of fullerons.
And it has a specific point at the earth.
Yes, in other words, it's at Thule, Greenland. You know, in other words, it's like if you look at the isagogic lines, it's so if that's geometric north, this thing is 11 degrees away from it. You know, where the magnetic lines all converge. It means that now you place on the earth, you place yourself in a kind of neutral zone, because the magnetic lines are canceling each other out. So in other words, it's later on when it spreads out that it goes into that business of having poles and stuff. And as a matter of fact, the one at the North Pole is actually south, because in every compass, you know, it says north on it. It's pointing to the south, and that's why. And Elvis said that he wanted his cryogenic device to be buried there, because it's the only place on the earth where the old south actually exists, but still exists. Okay, let's have Paul do 8 paintings on Elvis. You know, any way he wants to do.
Yeah.
And so what I did is you've got 6 things. Okay, 1, 2, 5, 6. Okay, you've got 6 paintings that, and then you get end pieces. Okay, so what I did was, I took the middle 6, since he was 42 years old, you know, so you've got each one's like 7 years, which is good because it's a cell exchange. You know, every 7 years you have a complete change of your bodily cells. And then, what?
Gotta go to a new audio.
Okay. And you want me to sing like Elvis too, right?
Oh, please.
Yeah.
Is that what you're trying to do? Okay.
Find out what time we're gonna go together.
Okay, all right, okay. Well, anyway, continuing. So I said, I will do this as like calendars, you know, like with a face at a certain point, you know, his youngest face, you know, middle, and then his last one where he was coming apart at the seams, you know, and then under it, I would divide this up into 7-year units, and then 12 months, so I had a calendar, so I could put facts in there, and then at the bottom, for every year, I had a significant painting. Little tiny thing that went through this, but the end ones were horoscopes, This is the horoscope of Elvis and his brother Jesse, his twin brother, and who died 25 minutes before he was born.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Who was buried in a shoebox in some unmarked grave.
Really?
It gave him the impetus for why he said he always had to live for two people. Then at the other end, you have the death horoscope of Elvis, plus the death horoscope of Jesse. That was going to be called like that. Because there were certain funny things. A car crashed at the wake, drove right into the crowd and killed people.
Really?
So I said, that's the second death of Jesse. I mean, this guy was a total comic book.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah. He had no, he had not nothing of the normal reality that we do. I mean, he did things like when he was in high school, he was doing L.A. Flash, meaning his hair had started to turn white. In the family, a lot of the people went gray and then white early. You know, you could see by his father, who never dyed his hair. So he used his mother's mascara and dye jobs and everything all over his face, and made his face look like Frankenstein, and he's walking around. Well, the thing is, he got away with it because nobody ever hit Elvis. You know, as you're growing up, somebody's going to take a whack at you.
Right?
Nobody ever did that for him.
Huh.
They always protected him. His mother would bring him to school, and come and get him and bring him back, And then eventually when he was able to go on his own, he was accompanied by other people, so that during his entire life, he was never alone.
Wow.
Omni magazine used to be in hard copy. In one of its last hard copy issues, they had a competition. And that was for $100,000 of insurance to be cryonically suspended. So they had a contest, like 500 words or less, why you should be the one selected. You know those kinds of contests?
Yeah.
I said, I can't resist that stuff.
Yeah,
right? So I wrote in and saying why I wanted to be, and because I say that I wanted to be able to skip stop through time and see the changes of sensibility. So that I really know what one worldview clashing to another meant, and that kind of stuff. Well, they didn't buy that. Yeah, what they selected was a guy who was a quadriplegic, a basket case, who was an out-of-work TV repairman. They said, in 200 years, there's not going to be any television, and there's certainly not going to be anybody repairing television sets. But they gave it to that guy, but there's only 400 people into this. So I figured, wow, that's another lost cause for me.
Would you still like to be cryogenically preserved?
I'm planning on it.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, but here's the scoop on this one. So I forgot all about this. Then about a couple of months later, I got a phone call from the guy that set up the contest, because Omni as guest curators, and stuff, and that way, who the hell was the guy that did it originally? Ben Bova, yeah, right, he was a science fiction writer,
right.
He knew from nothing about how to run stuff. But he was just a big name for them. And so then this guy calls me on the phone and starts saying, if you come to New York, we're going to have a meeting of some of the other people that are interested in being cryonically suspended. And I said, that's fantastic. And he says that for a minimal entry amount that you can get, you can get the type of insurance to make this happen. Now, at the same time, he said that in 1977, when Elvis died, that they broke up Alcor, which was the first company that did that had Dewar canisters, those canisters that that had four sections, you know, so you would be a foursome. Like you were playing bridge for eternity.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know about that.
And I started saying, well, who am I going to wake up with?
Yeah.
I know for a fact that Walt Disney didn't do it. There was a rumor about that. And then I said, I heard about this guy who's an unemployed TV repairman. I don't think I'll have much in common with that guy. So, is there anybody of stature or celebrities that I can relate to? And I started naming off people. And then I just mentioned Elvis is there. Elvis, yeah. I said, you mean to tell me that Elvis is already in the can? I said, can you prove that? And he says, I will do better than that. I will give you the personal phone number of Robert Ettinger, who wrote the book called The Prospect of Immortality in 1964, who started the whole thing. Gives you the phone number. I take the phone down, call up the number. The guy answers the phone. He was waiting for calls. You know, people that wait for telemarketers for calls are so lonely.
Yeah. Are you going to wake up with Elvis someday then?
No, let me just go through this. And so I was working on this last thing here. Mm-hmm. You know, like the last part. And I said, Mr. Ettinger, I can't remember the name of the guy, but he said so-and-so, you know, connected to the Omni competition for insurance for this. And he said, yes. And I said, well, tell me some of the events surrounding the Elvis selecting to do this. Well, he said, I used to work for Alcor at that time. You know, the government broke it up. And the reason they did that is like they broke up AT&T so that you would actually do what you said because you would be in competition with various organizations. And I said, when did you meet Elvis? He said, the year before he died. He said he knew he was going to die. He wanted to die on August 14th. Which was the day that his mother died. It was the day that he signed the contract with Colonel Tom Parker, you know, in 1958, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So he just went over 2 days. So he died on August 16th, you know, instead of like that. So I said, what went on here? And he said, we decided on two caskets, each going to weigh 900 pounds because there were freezing equipment under it. He would be waked in one, and then people would see his body, and they'd say, they know that was the real Elvis, and give him a little poke or something. And then there would be another one, which would be where this thing was closed up, and put into a white panel truck at night when no one was around, if there's any such possible anything in Graceland where nobody's around.
Right.
But the other one was then, they made a big ceremony about burying it across the street, across what is now Elvis Presley Parkway and Drive or something like that, in a small gravesite. 1 week later, Gould's dug it up and said, there's no Elvis in the casket, so he must be alive. So that started all the rumors, you know, that Gail Brewer DiGiorgio, you know, made the most money off her. And she even had, in one of those little pocketbooks, she had a cassette of somebody talking to Elvis on the telephone, you know, this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway, what actually occurred is that a woman named Brenda Peters, who at that time was the vice president of Alcor, she was from Canada, was elected to drive the truck out to Los Angeles. And then the body was going to be flown to Alaska, up above the 70 North Parallel, you know, where the temperature was cold enough. So if the gizmos broke down, you know, you still have time to reclaim it before cells burst, you know, in terms of going up and above and below 32 degrees, because that's where, you know, water expands and contracts, you know, going in either direction. So the I'm saying, I said, why hasn't Star, National Enquirer, World News Weekly known about this?
You know, Weekly World News is
they called it quits?
Yeah, the sales went bad.
Oh, no.
What is the world going to
do? I mean, there are no universal constants. I thought that thing would go on forever.
It was saving it, man. Yeah, it was.
But anyway, that's all these grocery store things that people believed in. And then I said, why don't they know about this? Why aren't there other books written about this? He says, because nobody asked me. And I said, that you mean you're giving me an exclusive? He said, yeah. I said, now I'm going to put that in a painting, a series of paintings that I'm doing on that. He said, and I'm going to write in there that you're one of the homages, that you're the other one that has told me an exclusive piece of information. Now,
none of these people here ever picked it up.
Well, okay.
And you still see Elvis is alive stories once in a while.
Right, in a Kmart, you know, this kind of stuff. Yeah. Now, the thing is that I said, that's not, the rest of the story is, I said, well, how did this work out? What went on? Well, I said, Brenda Peters drove out to Los Angeles and then had one of those small planes, you know, that has pontoons on it. You know, fuselage and stuff. Just, you know, a white plane. Go around Canada like that. She had one of them outfitted with a place to put the casket.
Wow.
And then she went to the Prince of Wales Island, which is where this thing where you're 11 degrees away from geometric north and where all the isogogic lines converge, you know, so you have like zero magnetism there.
Huh.
And the thing is buried down there, and the people who protect it are, I guess now, probably sons and daughters of Dar von der Melia. Now Dar von der Melia was a member of the Lafayette Escadrille. That's it. In the First World War, they were Canadian and American people of French ancestry that would like to be flyers, that were going to fight the Germans in there. You know, they were flying with biplanes and that kind of stuff. And so he's telling me all this stuff, and I just... Not only is my mind blowing, it's coming back together, right? Because I'm ricocheting all over the place. And I said, I can't believe this character is saying this stuff. And then he has all kinds of proofs of this.
Where was the magnetic anomaly?
It's 11 degrees below. It's on the Prince of Wales Island, you know, below geometric north, you know, where they put the flag for North Pole.
All right.
You have to go you have to go down in a certain one of those rungs there to where it is. Okay.
Okay.
But so they dug the holes and they put these DeWalt canisters. They're canisters filled with liquid nitrogen. You know, so that you can keep that almost at 270 degrees below zero, you know, which is like absolute zero or something. Well, and it isn't absolute, but I mean, but it's so cold that nothing's going to unfreeze from that unless you want it.
Right.
Now, they said, they wanted him to be unfrozen in about 150 years. And the reason for that is, This whole system doesn't work unless you have nanotechnology. Because given a single cell, you know, like you want to be able to, every time you start to thaw stuff out, you know, me and that way, there are only certain parts of your body that can move directly from a cold state to a warm state. So that when, and as you meet, as you near the 32 degrees, you've got to be ready with nanotechnology to reconstruct cell by cell the cells that are destroyed. And now that's a major task, and they estimated that it would require 5 or 6 years of constant activity. Now, and Elvis had a lot of money.
Yeah.
So he set aside a bundle and a half to keep that thing going.
Wow.
And what he wanted to do when he was awakened is to become a preacher, because he had like he had this thing that was a combination of a cross and the Star of David.
Right.
You know, you actually see some of those things in religious stores now. You know, the way.
Really?
Yeah. And what it is? It's because when his mother died, he discovered that her grandmother was Jewish. So therefore, he was actually partially Jewish.
Right.
But it follows the maternal line down.
Right.
And so he immediately, besides Christian symbols, he did the Alf and some other Jewish things on it. He was wearing them around his neck, and he changed the headstone for his mother and put a cross at one end and the Star of David at another, and then got the idea of having this would be the symbol of Jesse, who would become preaching as an Ebionite. The Ebionites were one of the three forms of Christianity. You know, like you had, they're really, today we call Jews for Jesus, that were popular in the 70s. Okay, you had the Gnostics, you had the Paulines, and you had the Ebionites. And so Jesse would become a preacher and go around the world, and they'd be seeing Elvis again.
Right.
Now, only the thing is that he said the person that when he'd come back, he would have no makeup. He would have, his hair would be blonde, because as a child, he had blonde hair. He didn't have black hair.
Huh.
See, the black hair was the stuff using his mother's makeup. Because her mother went gray, so she was always putting that stuff on her. And so he had the same situation.
And so then we have the return of Jesse.
Yeah, and so then he had blonde hair. That would have to probably be, henna rinse or some crap like that. You know, I mean, so he would look so different that he would look like he was in the movie Kissing Cousins.
Right.
Because it was Elvis playing two parts in the movie.
All right, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, but that's one. It's amazing to see him as he actually was.
Yeah.
Because your image of it always is the black-haired pompadour, you know, and all that crap, and the jet black and everything, and then here's this guy that looks kind of mild. You know, none of the animal ferocity that the makeup produced, you know.
Right.
Oh, okay. Okay. Now, as I said, during this conversation, I keep asking Ettinger, I said, are you really telling me the truth? And he says, yeah. And I said, why is it that no one else knows this? And he keeps repeating, because nobody ever asked me.
Right.
Because see, the Ettinger was an old guy when he wrote the book in 1964, because he was afraid he was going to die, you know, like that. And so I don't know whether he's in it or not. I mean, I think he may have been too scared to do it or something. But anyway, that for most people, he was out of the picture, and so his big thing was to get an order from Elvis to do it.
Okay.
So that's basically all I know about it.
That's amazing.
Can I ask
Wait. Could you please just tell me a little bit about that necklace?
Yeah, we got to get the Royale story. Again.
Okay. Yeah.
And your revenge part too, because we hadn't heard that before.
So. What?
Oh, the follow up to your, you know, when you two collided at the end later on.
Well, yeah. In other words, I don't know whether it did anything against him or for him, but he probably, because I got 11 pages, he only got 4 in the Kooks anthology.
First off, where did that necklace come from?
Okay, where I got it was from a guy named Giuseppe Conti. He was like, when I was 7 years old, this guy came to our front door in Belmont, Massachusetts, 17 Taylor Road, and came on a Saturday and my father was home. He says, I do landscaping and you know, odd jobs around somebody's house. So can I be like a person that comes every year to do your bushes, plant new flowers and vegetables, and generally shape up your lawn so that you're ready for the next planting season. And my father, who never liked to do that stuff, because he would always do it in formal clothes. he never had sports clothes.
Yeah.
You know, like today, there isn't anybody that isn't walking around in some kind of sports clothes.
Right.
He hated that.
Yeah.
He wore a Homburg hat and a Chesterfield to a bank. He was a banker. You know, so he had to be dressed with a certain dignity so that people would give him money.
Right.
You know, maybe that's the answer to begging in the street.
I've tested that.
A Chesterfield and a Homburg.
Tested that. It totally works.
Right.
There was a video about that, actually, where a guy in a suit asked for a quarter and then a homeless guy asked for a quarter. And everyone thinks the guy in the suit's like, oh, he needs to make a phone call.
Yeah, yeah, that's totally
right.
What we did.
Yeah. That's excellent.
Okay, so he comes over to be your caretaker.
Yeah,
your
well, I mean, and then, like he said, he comes every year. That he comes to neighborhoods. And so he said, pick a day. And I'll come next year at the same day. I'll do stuff now, you know, in that way. And so, you know, here I'm a 7-year-old kid. The inevitable occurs. Anytime a child experiences an alien adult, you know, something that comes into the home, becomes fascinated, you know, like follows them around. I was doing that. And so he started telling me about his other life, which was he came from Belmonte, Naples, you know, in Italy. He came to Belmont because it's the same word, you know, just an Italian, beautiful mountain. And what the mountain was referring to in Naples was Vesuvius, right? and so he said that he and his son went up. I would climb up on Mount Vesuvius, and so he was abducted 17 times. And I'm thinking, I lived 17 Taylor Road, so that 17 is some kind of number that's going to show up in my life, you know? And as the years went on, he started bringing me UFO paraphernalia as it became, you know, some articles about 1947, you know, stuff like this. And then, like when I'm about 15, he brings me some books. He brings me George Adamski's book, then the Amherst Press, and then the big one was Orfeo Angelucci's Secret of the Saucers, autographed by Orfeo. Got that still. that's going up in value as we speak.
Oh, I bet. Literally.
Oh, that's the edition that was used by Jung in his treatise on flying saucers.
Oh, okay.
You know, at the end he said somebody handed him a book, which then he examined it and said, it's like looking at the text for a new religion.
Right.
You know, so he considered it as such. Okay, so then the next year he comes back and he says, okay, I'm leaving, but and I'm never coming back, but I want you to have a particular gift. And with this gift, I want you to astound the world. Have you ever heard anybody say something when you astound the world?
Yeah. No, I don't need a guide from now on.
Okay.
I get telling people some, like, you have some responsibility.
Yeah, right. Okay, yeah. And I was stunned. And so that was the one. The thing was about that big. You know, and it had the Star of David. And then inside it had the swastika, you know, on one way, and then the opposite side it had the other, and it now it was like one part was overlapping. It was not like in the Israeli flag that just has lines, so you can't tell which is going over.
Right.
That, you know, so there's actual, and then this one was that way on that one. And then it was the other way on the other side. And so he's offering this to me. It looked like brass or some heavy metal. And so you know how, like, when somebody hands you something that's actually light, but you think it's heavy, your hand goes right up.
Right.
And I was shocked at this thing because it had a thickness to it. It was about that thick. You know, so it was a serious medallion there. And then he says, watch this. And he takes a thing that looks like an awl, you know where people drive stuff through leather, you know, to start sewing things. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a point on the end. He shoved it through the metal. And then took a string and followed that through. It was actually what an awl, you know that had a thimble or a reel of material there, and put it through. He healed around it, and then after a while he pulled it out and it healed over.
Whoa.
And so he says, I'm giving you this. Take good care of this, and I want to offer. All the good luck and everything that I can for you, like that. Okay, and then I said, you know, I said something that, like, my mother would say, is this a Nazi cult?
Right.
And I said, well, we just got through with the Second World War, where the Jews and the Nazis were the prime protagonists and antagonists going on in this whole thing. And he said, well, what they told me, says the, call them the others, that these were two forces that seemed dominant in the world, and we are leaving now and will not come back until those forces are resolved.
A rectification of duality once again.
And I said, what does that mean? It takes six Jews to control one Nazi?
Yeah. Good one.
So I took that in the house. I showed it to my folks, and I said, "What the hell was that? I mean, knew that guy was insane. I said, get rid of that thing." And so I said to myself, "This is the coolest thing a kid in my neighborhood ever got.
Yeah.
I am going to keep this." What they did is, you know, like in those Paris cafes, they have little round tables that are 18 inches in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
Real small ones.
Right.
Like, you can't eat a steak off that.
Right.
You know, it's not totally anti-American, you know, because you want to chow down and have room to do stuff and everything. You can't do it. So what you can get there is a wine glass and maybe a little plate with a with the, you know, an apricot tied or something on the sack. And then the rest of it is simply conversation. Okay, so I'm sitting there, and then flooding back into me is like, you know how like when somebody dumps you, there are waves of like relief, and then it starts to come back.
Yeah.
Well, I was sitting there by myself because there's nobody around me at that point. I'm looking straight to the Eiffel Tower. It's getting to be about 9:30, and in Paris, the sun doesn't go down until 10 in the summer.
Really?
And so that's one of the reasons why they call it the City of Light.
Huh.
It doesn't happen in other cities. I don't know what the hell is going on, but it was amazing. I thought that the sun stayed out all the time, you know. Okay, so I'm sitting there, the waiter comes over, and I said, can I have a Coke and an apricot tart? So he brings that out, and you know, and that's when you had those Coke bottles that looked like that with the thing, and they were green. He poured out the Coke and filled it with absinthe. And I had never had absinthe before, so I didn't know that he did that because you couldn't see through it because the bottle was green.
Right.
So I figured it was just a regular Coke.
Yeah.
And so I started swinging. I said, wait a minute. And since I normally don't drink, it hit me right away. You know, very smooth, but a loving rush at the end of the thing for each swing that you go through. And I said, wow, this must be a French Coke.
You call this La Coke here, right?
Right. And so I'm sitting there and I'm looking towards the Eiffel Tower, and I see somebody coming along, and it looks like Pat from a distance. You know how you start to see people that look like somebody that you hung up on? You know,
yeah,
that thing?
Yeah.
Okay, like the hair, same type of hair, a beret, a red bandana around the neck, and those kinds of sweaters with horizontal lines, you know, like the French Apaches, you know, like that.
Right.
You know, the clochard or something like that. Okay.
Right.
They pants that are like bell bottoms, and I'm sitting there. I'm wearing a numbered Harris tweed jacket, a black turtleneck sweater, light Dockers, and Oxfords. You know, thinking I was cool, but I have around my neck. I had this thing, you know, just sitting there.
Right.
It was kind of big.
That's,
you know,
layman,
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's coming along, and after a while, at first I thought it was her. I said, wow, she followed me to Paris.
Yeah.
Trying to make up. And, then I said, as he gets closer, I realized it's a guy. And he's coming straight towards me, and then sits down opposite to me in the chair.
Huh.
And I'm half in the bag for drinking this stuff. And I said, I don't know what to expect next. And so he says, I'd like to do an article about you, because I'm a stringer for Figaro and Paris Match. I also race cars, and I come from the middle of France, and my name is Claude Behilleron. And I said, okay. I said, well, why do you want to do this? He said, well, you're an American in Paris. And I said, well, isn't there a movie by that name, a song? You know,
yeah,
I mean, what is this? What is this Chimon doing? And so he said, well, what do you do? I said, well, I just got kicked out of architectural school, and I broke up with my girlfriend. So don't worry about anything. I will write a series of articles for you, so you get commissions for the rest of your life. And you can buy hitmen to get rid of her.
Oh, damn.
And the thing is, and he starts talking about this, and I start to explain it, and he says, I said, yeah, do you belong to some kind of Nazi cult?
Yeah.
And I said, no, I got this from a guy who ended up on Mount Vesuvius and was contacted by aliens. And he says, well, I relate to the swastika because my father was in the Vichy, you know, during the Second World War. And I think that's what enticed him, you know, to talk to me, because he probably thought I was a neo-Nazi or something. And I think he still is.
Right. Must indeed.
And so we're talking along, and I'm explaining, you know, the kind of designs I wanted to do and all this kind of stuff. And so at a certain point, he's reaching and getting pencils out and pens and more notebooks, and he's taking down all these phony notes. You know, he's probably just making lines on a piece of paper, right? And then he reaches in and he takes a knife out and he cuts the string off the thing, I'm about to eat the apricot tart. He grabs it out of my mouth, takes a bite and spits it out. So it must have been filled with absinthe, though. And so he's running down the street.
He stole your tart?
Yeah. Oh, no, but he stole
your necklace. I mean, he came at you with a knife. But just to think that he had the thought to, well, I want his tart, too.
Right.
That's too much.
And so he's running down the street. And I said, good God. There's the Marshall Plan in action. I mean, I was going to get rid of that, but I didn't expect to do it that way.
Right.
So I leaned back, and then finally the other people came out, and I told them what happened, and they started laughing their heads off, because they didn't even know who I was or anything. And so we went in and started talking about the whole thing, and Claudine showed up, and she had... you know, like she was pre-punk. She had earrings that were skulls. She had a side bag that said, "I am immortal." You know, the way people talk about James Dean.
Yeah.
She loved Americans.
Yeah.
And but by now that I am totally in the bag.
Yeah.
You know, and so that. So a whole lot of other stuff happened, but that's the part about Claude Bailleron. And so the next time I had anything to do with him is when Donna Cossey asked me to be in Coop's anthology. Well, I actually asked her, you know, because I thought it was great.
Yeah.
And she lives here in Portland.
Oh, really?
I was hoping that she'd show up to this.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
Yeah.
There was not much more kookier than what we just witnessed.
Yeah.
Two things I want to interject here. The first is for us. It is 7:08, and I've been told that we need to go by 7:30 in order to eat dinner and get you to the airport in time.
I agree with that.
Okay. So we've got about 20 more minutes. Then.
Okay, yeah.
And the second one is kind of for the viewers out there. Since this has been stolen from you, and Ra'el has, you know, built...
Well, it's Israel without the eye.
Exactly.
That's really what that word is.
It's, he's built a lot of occult power around it. And things like, you know, Edward Kelly's scrying crystal turn up missing.
Right, yeah.
So my suggestion to people is this is open for fair game.
Yeah.
Right. Someone out there should steal it for their ass.
Steal it back for Paul.
Yeah, and this original one is now in some kind of triple safe deposit box. You know, that kind of thing. Because, I mean, he makes more new ones that look like kids' pinwheels. You know, so they don't have the Nazi thing obvious, too. Especially if he's going to try and build an amusement park in Israel.
Right.